But even more valuable to the startup than their money, GV created a small team to go in and help the companies they invest in get their product efforts off to a good start. Their model is to typically spend a week with the startup, rolling up their sleeves and showing them how to do product discovery by doing it with them side by side. I also know several other proven product people, known as discovery coaches, who do essentially the same thing for the teams they are helping. In any case, during this week of intense discovery work, you and your team will likely explore dozens of different product ideas and approaches, with the goal of solving some significant business problem. You'll always end your week by validating your potential solution with real users and customers. And in my experience, the result is consistently big learning and insights, the kind of learning that can change the course of your product or your company. Within this general framework, discovery coaches advocate a variety of different methods to help the team through the process and get big learning in just 5 days. After working with more than 100 product teams and refining their methods as they learned what worked well and what didn't, the GV team decided to share their learnings in a book. The book is titled Sprint, How to Solve Big Problems and Test New Ideas in Just 5 Days by Jake Knapp, John Zaratsky, and Braden Cowitz. The authors lay out a 5-day week that starts with framing the problem by mapping the problem space, picking the problem to be solved and the target customer, and then progresses into pursuing several different approaches to the solution. The team next narrows down and fleshes out the different potential solutions, then creates a high-fidelity user prototype, finally putting that prototype in front of actual target users and observing their reactions. And yes, you can absolutely do this all in a week. Sprint spells out the author's favorite techniques to accomplish each of these steps, and if you've read this far, you'll recognize all of them. But what I like so much about the GV book is that when teams are getting started, they often crave the structure of a proven step-by-step recipe. The book spells out exactly this over nearly 300 pages with dozens of examples from great products and teams you'll recognize. There are several situations where I recommend a discovery sprint, starting with when the team has something big and critically important and/or difficult to tackle. Another situation where a discovery sprint helps is when the team is just learning how to do product discovery. And yet another is when things are just moving too slow and the team needs to recalibrate on just how fast they can and should be moving. Sprint is another must-read book for product managers, and I highly recommend it. Discovery coaches. As teams move to agile methods, they usually start with Scrum. Many companies decided to contract with or hire an agile coach. These coaches help the broader team, especially engineers, QA, product managers, and product designers, learn the methods and mindset involved in moving to agile. This sounds straightforward enough, but many problems arise because the vast majority of these agile coaches don't have experience with tech product companies. So their experience is limited to delivery. Therefore, they would more accurately be considered agile delivery coaches. They understand the engineering and release side of things, but not the discovery side of things. So many product companies have experienced this issue that it created the need for coaches that do have deep experience with product companies and the key product roles, especially product management and product design. These individuals are often called discovery coaches. Discovery coaches are typically former product managers or product designers or former leaders of these areas, and they have usually worked for or with leading product companies. So they are able to work side by side with actual product managers and designers, not just reciting agile platitudes, but showing the team how to work effectively. Every discovery coach has his or her preferred way of engaging with a team, but they are usually engaged with one or a small number of product teams for a week or so. During this time, they help you through one or more discovery cycles of ideation, creating prototypes, and validating the prototypes with customers to gauge their reactions, with engineers to evaluate feasibility, and with business stakeholders to assess whether the solution would work for your business. It's hard for me to imagine an effective discovery coach who doesn't have firsthand experience as a product manager or product designer at a modern product company. That's likely one of the main reasons there's a shortage of discovery coaches today. It's also important that discovery coach understand how to include engineering in the mix, being sensitive to their time, but understanding the essential role they play in innovation. Discovery coaches are not unlike lean startup coaches. The main difference is that lean startup coaches often focus on helping a team discover not only their product, but also their business model and their sales and marketing strategy. Once the new business has some traction, the discovery is usually more about continuously improving an existing product in substantial ways rather than creating an all-new business. Because of this difference, many lean startup coaches don't have the necessary product experience. My view is that product discovery is the most important competency of a new startup, so I believe an effective lean startup coach must also be very strong at product. Chapter 59, Pilot Team Technique. Earlier in this book, we discussed the technology adoption curve and how this theory describes how different people will accept change. It turns out this theory also applies to our own organization and especially to how we make changes to how that organization works. Some people in your organization love change. Some want to see someone else use it successfully first. Some need more time to digest changes, and a few hate change and will only change if they're forced to do it. If you get too excited and roll out a significant change to everyone in your organization at once, then the laggards, those that hate change, may resist or even sabotage your efforts. Rather than fight this reality, we can embrace it. One of the simplest techniques for facilitating moving to new ways of working is the use of pilot teams. Pilot teams allow the rollout of change to a limited part of the organization before implementing it more broadly. The idea is that you look for a product team to volunteer to try out some new techniques. You let them run for a while, usually a quarter or two, with this new way of working and see how this goes. Your specific success measures will depend on your goals, but ultimately, you're looking to compare the team's effectiveness in delivering business outcomes. That is, how well do the pilot teams accomplish their objectives versus the others or compared to how they did in the past? Given the nature of the experiment, your comparisons will be qualitative, but that doesn't make them any less compelling. If things go well, you'll likely end up with several other teams eager to adopt. If things don't go well, you might decide this technique is not a fit for you, or you might decide to make adjustments. To maximize the chance of the pilot teams having a good outcome, we carefully consider the people involved, their location, and their degree of autonomy. Ideally, we have people who are open to new ways of working, the key people on the team are co-located, and the team is largely in control of how they work and not so dependent on other teams that still work in the old way. Chapter 60, Weaning an Organization Off Roadmaps. Many product teams want to move off product roadmaps, but their organizations are old school, addicted to the outdated quarterly product roadmap. As a result, they don't see how to transition their organizations forward. Here's what I advocate in this case. Plan to continue with your existing roadmap process for 6 to 12 months. However, starting immediately, every time you reference a product roadmap item or discuss it in a presentation or meeting, be sure to include a reminder of the actual business outcome that feature is intended to help. If the feature you're working on is to add PayPal as a payment method, and the reason is to increase conversion, then be sure to always show the current conversion rate and the result you're hoping to achieve. Most important, after the feature goes live, be sure to highlight the impact on that conversion rate. If the impact was good, celebrate it. If the impact was not what was hoped, then emphasize to everyone that while you did ship the feature, the result was not successful. Point out specifically what was learned, but explain that you have other ideas for ways to get the desired result. The goal is that over time, it could take as long as a year, the organization moves its focus from specific features launching on specific dates to business results. For this to work, it's important to acknowledge the two big reasons why stakeholders especially are so attracted to roadmaps. One, they want some visibility into what you are working on and assurance that you are working on the most important items. Two, they want to be able to plan the business and need to know when critical things will happen. The modern alternative to roadmaps discussed here addresses both of these concerns. Teams work on the prioritized business objectives determined by the leaders. We share our key results transparently, and we commit to high-integrity commitments when critical delivery dates are needed. Process at scale. Overview. It is understandable that, as companies grow, they become more risk-averse. When you're small, there really isn't much to lose. But as you get to scale, there is quite a lot on the line, and many people from across the company are there to try to protect those assets. One way companies try to protect what they've achieved is to institute process by formalizing and standardizing how things are done in the name of reducing error or risk. This applies from how we get reimbursed for travel expenses, to how we request a change to a report, to how we discover and deliver product. In many areas, such as expense reporting, it's an irritant, but not likely to make the difference between success and failure of the company. On the other hand, it is all too easy to institute processes that govern how you produce products that can bring innovation to a grinding halt. Nobody does this intentionally, but it happens so frequently in so many companies that I find it quite remarkable. As just one example in the process area, agile methods are generally very conducive to consistent innovation. Yet there are several process consultancies that specialize in agile at scale, which introduce methods and structures intended to scale to large numbers of engineers. Yet there are several process consultancies that specialize in agile at scale, which introduce methods and structures intended to scale to large numbers of engineers, yet which absolutely destroy any hope of innovation. It does not have to be this way. Many of the best product companies in the world are very large companies that have successfully scaled their product and technology organizations. The techniques and methods described here are all about maintaining your ability to consistently innovate as you continue to grow and scale. Chapter 61, Managing Stakeholders. For many product managers, managing stakeholders is probably the least favorite part of their job. I don't want to suggest that this will always be easy, but it can usually be substantially improved. First, let's consider just who is a stakeholder. Then what the product manager's responsibilities are with these stakeholders. After that, we'll talk about techniques for success. Stakeholder defined. In many product companies, just about anyone and everyone feels like they have a say in the products. They certainly care about the product, and they often have many ideas, either derived from their own use or from what they hear from customers. But regardless of what they think, we would not consider most of them to be stakeholders. They are just part of the community at large, another source of input on the product along with many others. One practical test of whether a person is considered a stakeholder is whether or not they have veto power or can otherwise prevent your work from launching. This group of people typically includes the executive team, CEO and leaders of marketing, sales, and technology, business partners to make sure the product and the business are aligned, finance to make sure the product fits within the financial parameters and model of the company, legal to make sure what you propose is defensible, compliance to make sure what you propose complies with any relevant standards or policies, business development to make sure what you propose does not violate any existing contracts or relationships. There can be others, but you get the idea. In a startup, there are few stakeholders because the company is very small, and frankly, there's not a lot to lose. But in large companies, quite a few people are there to protect the substantial assets of the company. Product manager responsibilities. In terms of the stakeholders, the product manager has the responsibility to understand the considerations and constraints of the various stakeholders and to bring this knowledge into the product team. It doesn't do anyone any good to build things that may work for the customer, but then at some review meeting find out that you're not allowed to deploy what was created. This happens much more than you might realize, and every time it does happen, the company loses a little more confidence in the product team. However, beyond understanding the constraints and concerns of each stakeholder, if you want the latitude to come up with the most effective solutions, then it's critically important that the product manager convince each of these stakeholders that she not only understands the issues, but that she is committed to coming up with solutions that not only work for the customer, but also work for the stakeholder as well. And this must be sincere. I emphasize this because if the stakeholder does not have this trust that you are going to solve for their concerns as well, then they will either escalate or they will try to control. Strategies for success. Success in terms of stakeholder management means that your stakeholders respect you and your contribution. They trust that you understand their concerns and will ensure solutions work well for them too. They trust that you will keep them informed of important decisions or changes, and most of all, they give you the room to come up with the best solutions possible, even when those solutions end up being quite different from what they might have originally envisioned. It's not that difficult to have this kind of relationship with stakeholders, but it does require first and foremost that you are a competent product manager. This especially means having a deep understanding of your customers, the analytics, the technology, your industry, and in particular, your business. Without this, they won't trust you. And in fairness, they shouldn't. The main way we demonstrate this knowledge to the organization is by sharing very openly what we learn. With this as a foundation, the key technique is to spend one-on-one time with the key stakeholders. Sit down with them and listen. Explain that the better you understand their constraints, the better your solutions will be. Ask lots of questions. Be open and transparent. One of the most common mistakes product managers make with stakeholders is that they show them their solution after they have already built it. And sometimes there are issues because the product manager did not have a clear enough understanding of the constraints. Not only will the stakeholder be frustrated, but your engineering team will be frustrated as well with all the rework. So commit to previewing your solutions during discovery with the key stakeholders before you put this work on the product backlog. This is one of the keys of product discovery. In discovery, you are not only making sure that your solutions are valuable and usable with customers and feasible with engineers, but you are also making sure your stakeholders will support the proposed solution. The other big mistake I often see being made is when situations boil down to the product manager's opinion versus the stakeholder's opinion. In this case, the stakeholder usually wins because he or she is usually more senior. However, as we've already discussed many times before, the key is to change the game by quickly running a test and collecting some evidence. Move the discussion from opinions to data. Share what you're learning very openly. It may be that neither of your opinions were right. Again, the discovery work is designed specifically as a place for these tests. Mostly, this is about creating a collaborative, mutually respectful personal relationship. For most companies, it takes about 2 to 3 hours a week, meeting for half an hour or so with each key stakeholder to keep them apprised and to get their feedback on new ideas. My favorite way to do this is a weekly lunch or coffee with your most involved stakeholders. Many product managers tell me the way they deal with testing business viability with all their different stakeholders is by scheduling a large group meeting and inviting all the stakeholders. The product manager then presents to them what they want to build, usually with a PowerPoint presentation. There are two very serious, potentially career-limiting, problems with this. First, presentations are notoriously terrible for testing business viability. The reason is that they are far too ambiguous. A lawyer needs to see the actual proposed screens, pages, and wording. A marketing leader wants to see the actual product design. A security leader needs to see exactly what the product is trying to do. Presentations are terrible for this. In contrast, high-fidelity user prototypes are ideal for this. I plead with product managers in larger companies to not trust a sign-off on anything other than a high-fidelity prototype. I have seen far too many times where the execs agree to something based on a presentation, but when they see the actual product, they are completely shocked, frustrated, and often visibly angry. The second problem is that a group setting is not the forum for designing strong products. It results in design by committee, which yields mediocre results at best. Instead, meet privately with each stakeholder, show them the high-fidelity prototype, and give them the chance to raise any concerns. This may sound like more work to you, but please believe me that, in the long run, it will turn out to be far less work, time, and grief. One final note. In many companies, some of the stakeholders may not even understand what product does, and some may even feel threatened by the role. Be sensitive to this. You may need to spend some time explaining the role and how technology-enabled product companies operate and why. Devolving from good to bad. Lots of people have written about the challenges of managing growth, and especially about the importance of working hard to maintain staff quality as you scale the organization. There is little question that most organizations become worse in their ability to rapidly deliver consistent innovation as they grow. Yet most people attribute this to staff quality, process, and communication issues of scale. Some believe that this is unavoidable. There's an anti-pattern I see in many companies that are doing very well, growing aggressively, yet they will sometimes, over time and unintentionally, replace their good behaviors with bad ones. I have never seen this anti-pattern written about before, and I suspect it's going to make more than a few people uncomfortable. But it's a serious issue that I think needs to be out in the open, and it's not hard to prevent if you're aware. The scenario is that you are probably a later stage startup or growth stage company. You've probably achieved product market fit, at least for an initial product. And to have accomplished that, you've probably done some important things right. But then you get some substantial funding, or a board member strongly suggests that you need to bring on some adult supervision or some experienced people from brand name companies. Here's the thing. The new people you hire are often from those large brand name companies that have stopped growing, have long since lost their ability to innovate, and have been living off their brand for many years. Because of this, they're not on the trajectory they once were, and people leave. Would you rather hire all of your staff and leaders from Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Netflix? Sure you would, but these people are in very short supply, and there is lots of strong talent at other companies. But let's say you're at a young, growth stage company, and you decide to hire a senior leader, maybe the head of product, or the head of engineering, or the head of marketing, from a brand name like Oracle. Your board will probably like that. The issue is that, unless you make this clear at the outset, that new leader may assume you're hiring them for their knowledge of process and how to define and deliver products. And so, they bring with them their views on how things should work, Even worse, they often then proceed to hire people that want to work in those ways. Note that I'm picking on Oracle here as an example, but they are certainly not the only one. There are a great many very strong people to hire from Oracle, as they love to acquire companies, often very good companies. But those strong product design and technology people they also acquired rarely like Oracle's culture or ways of creating product. I have seen this anti-pattern play out at every level of a company, from individual engineers all the way to CEO. It doesn't happen overnight. It happens over years. But I've seen it enough to be convinced it's an anti-pattern. Many people intuitively sense this problem, but they usually just attribute it to a big company person. But this is less about being from a big company and more about being from a company that's not strong at product. I know of two ways to prevent this problem from infecting your company. The first is to have a very strong and very intentional product culture, and to have that culture very well established so that new hires know they're joining a different type of company that takes pride in how they work and in using best practices. When you join Netflix or Airbnb or Facebook, it's something you figure out in your first days, and that's their intention. The second way of preventing this is to make this explicit in the interview and onboarding process. As part of my advisory work, I'm often on the interview team for senior positions. And when the person is coming from one of these types of companies, I'm upfront with the prospective hire. We'll talk about the reasons why their former company has not produced successful new products in many years. And I'll emphasize to them that the new company is interested in them because of their mind and their talents. And of course, they wouldn't want to bring with them the bad practices of their former company. In my experience, people are really good about this when you talk openly and honestly about it. In fact, people often tell me it's a major reason why they want to leave their former company. It's more about getting this to be something you and they are very aware of. Chapter 62, Communicating Product Learnings. Sharing what we learn in the startup happens naturally because the product team and the company are pretty much the same thing. However, as companies scale, this becomes substantially more difficult, yet it also becomes increasingly important to do. A technique I love for helping with this is for the head of product at a company all hands or similar meeting every week or two to take 15 to 30 minutes to highlight what has been learned in product discovery across the various product teams. Note that this is meant to cover the bigger learnings and not the minor things. What worked, what didn't work, and what the teams are planning to try the following week. This update needs to move fast and kept at the big learnings level. This is why I prefer the VP product to do this. This is not where every product manager parades in front of everyone for a detailed update, taking 1 to 2 hours of time and at more detail than most people want to see. It's not meant to be a repeat of sprint reviews either. Instead, the update is meant to address several purposes, some tactical and some cultural. The big learnings are important to share broadly, especially when things don't go as hoped. As a side benefit, sometimes someone in the audience has an insight about what might explain the results. This is a useful and easy way for the various product teams to keep apprise of what other teams are learning, as well as ensuring that useful learnings make it to the leaders. This technique encourages the product teams to keep their focus on big learnings and not on minor experimentation that doesn't have a real customer or business impact one way or the other. Culturally, it's critical that the organization understand that discovery and innovation is about continuously running these rapid experiments and learning from the results. It is also important culturally that the product organization be transparent and generous in what they learn and how they work. It helps the broader organization to understand that the product organization is not there to serve the business, but rather to solve problems for our customers in ways that work for our business. Chapter 63, Profile, Camille Hurst of Apple. I'd love to introduce you to another very strong product manager, Camille Hurst. Camille was a product manager on the iTunes team at Apple. And as you might imagine, with such a disruptive and groundbreaking product, she experienced and learned a great deal during her formative product years at Apple. This was especially the case because she was there during the years moving from iTunes' original DRM-based music to DRM-free, which was critical in helping iTunes become truly mass market. Moving beyond early adopters into mass market involved many different efforts, some product, some marketing, and some a blend of the two. A good example of this blend was the relationship the iTunes team engaged with the American Idol television program. This turned out to be one of the most dramatic and visible, yet challenging, product efforts for the iTunes team. During 2008, American Idol was a cultural icon, watched by more than 25 million people twice a week, with a level of repeat engagement that was largely unrivaled. Apple saw in this an opportunity to expose an ideal target market to the power of iTunes and digital music. Not just by selling the music from the contestants featured on the show, but by making iTunes an integral part of consumers' lives. However, while the potential was substantial, the challenges were significant as well. The VP of iTunes, Eddie Q, and others made the business deal. But Camille worked as product manager on many of the integrations to help figure this out. As just one example, the American Idol program is all about voting, and Apple quickly realized that sales of contestants' music would very likely be strongly indicative of voting results. So while normally iTunes was designed to show trending music and highlight popular titles, in this case, it was important to use extreme care not to influence the voting. This was obviously critically important to the Idol producers. It would reduce or even eliminate the suspense to learn which contestants would continue to the next week. The integration also allowed the team to target a very specific persona and work to drive up engagement with this group. One of the keys was to make it easy to get to iTunes for those that didn't yet have the app installed. By tackling these and countless other challenges head-on, Camille and her team came up with technology solutions that complemented the American Idol experience, yet also injected iTunes as a key component of fans' lives. This contributed to what was in 2014, before the move to streaming, a roughly $20 billion business. To me, this is a great example of how product managers work to find creative solutions to very difficult problems. Camille went on to join the YouTube team and then lead product at London-based Halo. Now I'm very happy to say that she's CEO of a New York-based startup. Part 5. The Right Culture. We've worked through quite a lot of information, and I believe it would be useful at this point to step back and consider the range and scope of how the product manager role is defined, how these people work collaboratively with their product team, and the techniques they use to quickly come up with products worth building and delivering to customers. It's easy to get hung up on the minutiae of all this, but what's really important here is creating the right product culture for success. In these final chapters, I'll push your focus to what's most important to your success. In particular, how does a great product team behave, and how do strong product companies provide these teams with an environment where they can flourish? Chapter 64, Good Product Team, Bad Product Team. I've had the extremely good fortune to be able to work with many of the best technology product teams in the world, the people creating the products you use and love every day, teams that are literally changing the world. I've also been brought in to try to help with companies that are not doing so well, startups racing to get some traction before the money runs out, larger companies struggling to replicate their early innovation, teams failing to continuously add value to their business, leaders frustrated with how long it takes to go from idea to reality. Engineers exasperated with their product managers. What I've learned is that there is a profound difference between how the very best product companies create technology products and all the rest. And I don't mean minor differences. Everything from how the leaders behave to the level of empowerment of teams to how the organization thinks about funding, staffing, and producing products, down to how product design and engineering collaborate to discover effective solutions for their customers. With a grateful nod to Ben Horowitz's classic post, Good Product Manager, Bad Product Manager, for those that have not yet had the opportunity to participate in or observe a strong product team up close, in this chapter, I provide you with a glimpse into some of the important differences between strong product teams and weak teams. Good teams have a compelling product vision that they pursue with a missionary-like passion. Bad teams are mercenaries. Good teams get their inspiration and product ideas from their vision and objectives, from observing customers struggle, from analyzing the data customers generate from using their product, and from constantly seeking to apply new technology to solve real problems. Bad teams gather requirements from sales and customers. Good teams understand who each of the key stakeholders are. They understand the constraints that these stakeholders operate in, and they are committed to inventing solutions that work not just for users and customers, but also work within the constraints of the business. Bad teams gather requirements from stakeholders. Good teams are skilled in the many techniques to rapidly try out product ideas to determine which ones are truly worth building. Bad teams hold meetings to generate prioritized roadmaps. Good teams love to have brainstorming discussions with smart thought leaders from across the company. Bad teams get offended when someone outside their team dares to suggest they do something. Good teams have product design and engineering sit side by side, and they embrace the give and take between the functionality, the user experience, and the enabling technology. Bad teams sit in their respective silos and ask that others make requests for their services in the form of documents and scheduling meetings. Good teams are constantly trying out new ideas to innovate, but doing so in ways that protect the revenue and protect the brand. Bad teams are still waiting for permission to run a test. Good teams insist they have the skill sets on their team, such as strong product design, necessary to create winning products. Bad teams don't even know what product designers are. Good teams ensure that their engineers have time to try out the prototypes in discovery every day so that they can contribute their thoughts on how to make the product better. Bad teams show the prototypes to the engineers during sprint planning so they can estimate. Good teams engage directly with end users and customers every week to better understand their customers and to see the customer's response to their latest ideas. Bad teams think they are the customer. Good teams know that many of their favorite ideas won't end up working for customers, and even the ones that could will need several iterations to get to the point where they provide the desired outcome. Bad teams just build what's on the roadmap and are satisfied with meeting dates and ensuring quality. Good teams understand the need for speed and how rapid iteration is the key to innovation, and they understand this speed comes from the right techniques and not forced labor. Bad teams complain they are slow because their colleagues are not working hard enough. Good teams make high-integrity commitments after they've evaluated the request and ensure they have a viable solution that will work for the customer and the business. Bad teams complain about being a sales-driven company. Good teams instrument their work so that they can immediately understand how their product is being used and make adjustments based on the data. Bad teams consider analytics and reporting a nice-to-have. Good teams integrate and release continuously, knowing that a constant stream of smaller releases provides a much more stable solution for their customers. Bad teams test manually at the end of a painful integration phase and then release everything at once. Good teams obsess over their reference customers. Bad teams obsess over their competitors.
Good teams celebrate when they achieve a significant impact to the business results.
Bad teams celebrate when they finally release something. If a significant number of these items strike too close to home, I hope you'll consider raising the bar for your team. See if you can't use the techniques in this book to experience the difference. Chapter 65, Top Reasons for Loss of Innovation. I define consistent innovation as the ability of a team to repeatedly add value to the business. Many organizations lose their ability to innovate at scale, and this is incredibly frustrating to both leaders and the members of the product teams. It's one of the main reasons people often leave large companies for startups. But losing the ability to innovate is absolutely and demonstrably not inevitable. Some of the most consistently innovative companies in our industry are very large. Consider Amazon, Google, Facebook, and Netflix as examples. Organizations that lose the ability to innovate at scale are inevitably missing one or more of the following attributes. 1. Customer-centric culture. As Jeff Bezos, the CEO of Amazon, says, customers are always beautifully, wonderfully dissatisfied, even when they report being happy and business is great. Even when they don't know it yet, customers want something better, and your desire to delight customers will drive you to invent on their behalf. Companies that don't have this focus on customers and direct and frequent contact with them lose this passion and critical source of inspiration. 2. Compelling product vision. By the time many companies reach scale, their original product vision is now largely realized, and the team is struggling to understand what's next. This is often compounded because the original founders may have moved on, and they were likely the keepers of the vision. In this case, someone else, usually either the CEO or the VP product, needs to step up and fill this void. 3. Focused product strategy. One of the surest paths to product failure is to try to please everyone at once. Yet large companies often forget this reality. The product strategy needs to spell out a logical and intentional sequence of target markets for the product teams to focus on. 4. Strong product managers. The lack of a strong and capable product manager is typically a major reason for lack of product innovation. When a company is small, the CEO or one of the co-founders usually plays this role. But at scale, each product team depends on a strong and capable product manager. 5. Stable product teams. One of the prerequisites for consistent innovation is a team that has had a chance to learn the space, technologies, and customer pain. This doesn't happen if the members of the team are constantly shifting. 6. Engineers in discovery. So often the key to innovation is the engineers on the team, but this means A, including them from the very beginning and not just at the end, and B, exposing them directly to the customer pain. 7. Corporate courage. It's no secret that many companies become extremely risk-averse as they grow larger. There is, of course, much more to lose. But the best technology product companies know that the riskiest strategy of all is to stop taking risks. We do have to be smart about how we work, but the willingness to risk disruption to our current business is essential to consistent innovation. 8. Empowered product teams. Even though your organization might have begun by using best practices, many organizations regress as they scale. And if you've reverted to just handing your teams roadmaps of features, then you no longer can expect the benefits of empowered product teams. Remember that empowerment means the teams are able to tackle and solve the business problems they've been assigned in the best way they see fit. 9. Product mindset. In an IT mindset organization, the product teams exist to serve the needs of the business. In contrast, in a product mindset organization, the product teams exist to serve the company's customers in ways that meet the needs of the business. The resulting differences between these mindsets are many and profound. 10. Time to innovate. At scale, it's very possible that your product teams are entirely consumed just doing what we call keep the lights on activities. Fixing bugs, implementing capabilities for different parts of the business, addressing technical debt, and more. If this is your situation, you shouldn't be surprised at the lack of innovation. Some of this is normal and healthy, but be sure that your teams have the room to also pursue harder and more impactful problems. I hope you notice that the above list essentially describes a culture of consistent innovation. It's much more about culture than it is about process or anything else. Chapter 66, Top Reasons for Loss of Velocity. As organizations grow, it's not unusual for things to slow down. They don't need to, and in the best organizations, they can accelerate. But if you are seeing a slowdown, these are the first things to look for. 1. Technical debt. Often the architecture does not facilitate or enable the rapid evolution of the product. This is not something that can be fixed overnight, but it needs to be attacked in an ongoing and concerted effort. 2. Lack of strong product managers. The lack of a strong and capable product manager is typically a major reason for slow product. The impact of a weak product manager shows up in many ways, but it shows up very visibly as a team of mercenaries rather than missionaries. The product manager has not inspired or evangelized to the team, or the team has lost confidence in their product manager. 3. Lack of delivery management. The most important function of the delivery manager is to remove impediments, and the list of impediments grows non-linearly as the technology organization grows. Most impediments won't go away quickly without someone actively chasing them down. 4. Infrequent release cycles. Most teams with slow velocity have release vehicles that are too infrequent. Your team should release no less frequently than every 2 weeks. Very good teams release multiple times per day. Correcting this typically means getting serious about test automation and release automation so the team can move quickly and release with confidence. 5. Lack of product vision and strategy. It's essential that the team have a clear vision of the big picture and how their immediate work contributes to the whole. 6. Lack of co-located, durable product teams. If teams are split across locations, or worse, if engineers are outsourced, besides the dramatic decrease in innovation, the velocity of the organization will suffer significantly. Even simple communication becomes difficult. It gets so bad that many outsourcing firms will add another layer of people to coordinate and communicate, which usually makes things worse. 7. Not including engineers early enough during product discovery. The engineers need to participate in product discovery from the start of ideation. They will often contribute alternative approaches that can be significantly faster to implement if you include them early enough in the process for the product manager and designer to adjust. If not, their critical input will come too late in the process. 8. Not utilizing product design and discovery and instead having them try to do their work at the same time the engineers are trying to build.
Not doing this will both slow things down and lead to poor designs.
9. Changing priorities. Realize that rapidly shifting priorities cause significant churn and substantially reduces the total throughput and morale. 10. A consensus culture. Many organizations strive for consensus. While this typically comes from good intentions, what this means in practice is decisions are very hard to make and everything slows to a crawl. There are, of course, any number of other causes of slow product, but in my experience, these are among the most common culprits. Chapter 67, Establishing a Strong Product Culture. While we've talked about product teams and techniques for discovering successful products, I hope you've noticed that what we're really talking about in this book is product culture. I've described to you how great product companies think, organize, and operate. I think of product culture along two dimensions. The first dimension is whether the company can consistently innovate to come up with valuable solutions for their customers. This is what product discovery is all about. The second dimension is execution.
It doesn't matter how great the ideas are if you can't get a productized, shippable version delivered to your customers.
This is what product delivery is all about. My goal in this final chapter is to describe the characteristics of a strong innovation culture versus those of a strong execution culture. What does it really mean to have a strong innovation culture? Culture of experimentation. Teams know they can run tests, some will succeed and many will fail, and this is acceptable and understood. Culture of open minds. Teams know that good ideas can come from anywhere and aren't always obvious at the outset. Culture of empowerment. Individuals and teams feel empowered to be able to try out an idea. Culture of technology. Teams realize that true innovation can be inspired by new technology and analysis of data, as well as by customers. Culture of business and customer savvy teams. Teams, including developers, have a deep understanding of the business needs and constraints and understanding of and access to the users and customers. Culture of skill set and staff diversity. Teams appreciate that different skills and backgrounds contribute to innovative solutions, especially engineering, design, and product. Culture of discovery techniques. The mechanisms are in place for ideas to be tested out quickly and safely, protecting brand, revenue, customers, and colleagues. What does it really mean to have a strong execution culture? Culture of urgency. People feel like they are in wartime, and that if they don't find a way to move fast, then bad things could happen. Culture of high integrity commitments. Teams understand the need for and power of commitments, but they also insist on high integrity commitments. Culture of empowerment. Teams feel as though they have the tools, resources, and permission to do whatever is necessary to meet their commitments. Culture of accountability. People and teams feel a deep responsibility to meet their commitments. Accountability also implies consequences. Not necessarily being terminated, except in extreme and repeated situations, but more likely, consequences to their reputations among their peers. Culture of collaboration. While team autonomy and empowerment is important, teams understand their even higher need to work together to accomplish many of the biggest and most meaningful objectives. Culture of results. Is the focus on output, or is the focus on results? Culture of recognition. Teams often take their cues from what is rewarded and what is accepted. Is it just the team that comes up with the great new idea that gets rewarded, or the team that delivered on a brutally tough commitment? And what is the message if missing a commitment is seen as easily excusable? So if these characteristics help define each culture, this begs some pretty tough questions. Is an innovation culture in any way inherently at odds with an execution culture? Does a strong execution culture lead to a stressful, or worse, work environment? What types of people, including leaders, are attracted to and needed for each type of culture? I can tell you that there do exist companies that are very strong at both consistent innovation and execution. Amazon is one of the best examples. However, it's also well known that the Amazon work environment is not for the faint of heart. I've found that most companies that are exceptionally strong at execution are pretty tough places to work. In my experience working with companies, only a few companies are strong at both innovation and execution. Many are good at execution but weak at innovation. Some are strong at innovation and just okay at execution. And a depressing number of companies are poor at both innovation and execution. Usually older companies that lost their product mojo a long time ago, but still have a strong brand and customer base to lean on. In any case, what I hope you and your team will consider doing is assess yourself along these dimensions of innovation and execution, and then ask yourselves where you would like to be or think you need to be as a team or company. Acknowledgements. The very nature of putting together this book on sharing best practices from the industry's best product companies means that I've learned from a great many exceptional people. I have been especially fortunate to have had the chance to work with and for some of our industry's best product minds and companies. I have learned from each one of these people, but some of them have made such a deep impression on me that I must thank them here. First and foremost, my partners at the Silicon Valley Product Group. They are my colleagues now precisely because I have been so impressed with their talents and have learned so much from each of them over the years. Leah Hickman, Martina Luchenko, and Chris Jones. I must also thank Peter Economy, Jeff Patton, and Richard Naramore for their help reviewing and improving this book. The genesis of this book was material developed at Netscape Communications. Netscape provided an unparalleled learning opportunity, and I gained much insight about product and leadership by working for and with truly brilliant minds, including Mark Andreessen, Barry Appleman, Jennifer Bailey, Jim Barksdale, Peter Curry, Eric Hahn, Basil Hashem, Mike Homer, Ben Horowitz, Omid Kordestani, Kang Lim, Bob Lisbon, Debbie Meredith, Mike McHugh, Danny Shader, Sharmila Shahani, Ram Shuram, Bill Turpin, and David Wyden. At eBay, I have to especially credit Marty Abbott, Mike Fisher, Chuck Geiger, Jeff Jordan, Josh Koppelman, Sri Mahesh, Pierre Omidjar, Lynn Reedy, Stephanie Telenius, and Maynard Webb. Each one of these people has directly influenced me and informed specific topics in this book, either by their explicit help and coaching or simply by way of their leadership and actions that I was fortunate enough to witness firsthand. While my time working for these exceptional companies was an invaluable learning experience, I found that as I began working with tech teams in my advisory and coaching work as part of SVPG, I benefited greatly by getting a chance to meet and work with the product leaders at many of the very best companies in our industry. There are simply too many people to list, but they know who they are, and I am grateful to every one of them. This book is based on material produced for a blog and newsletter that I have published for many years, and each and every topic was improved thanks to feedback and comments from literally thousands of product managers and product leaders from every corner of the globe. I thank everyone who has read, shared, and commented on these articles. Finally, those people who know the culture of the companies I've worked at understand that many very long hours were involved, and I could not have contributed to these companies without the support of my wife and children.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Inspired, How to Create Tech Products Customers Love, Second Edition. Written and performed by Marty Kagan. Executive producers Laura Gachko and Mike Jarzik. Producer Chris Sacco. Copyright 2018 by Wiley. Sound recording copyright 2018 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.